Good evening and welcome back to Editing Aloud. I have with me a panel of South Africa's best and most thoughtful journalists. At a time when the Rand has been tanking, Ron Darby, is this the end of Ramaphosa? Everything that we thought December's election had won us, we've now lost.
But I don't think it's Ramaphosa. Maybe Ramaphosa has saved us from the worst of the fallout that's happened over the past week. No, Argentinian. I don't know if we should even talk about the Argentinian currency in any serious forum. But I mean, it saved us in this instance. It's only down about 3% last I checked since Ramaphosa was appointed the ANC president. Over the past month, it is amongst the worst four. But we do over the 6 months. I mean, Ramaphosa has helped us in a sense, so it's cushioned the blow. But emerging markets are in a spot of bother with the Fed tomorrow. Is it tomorrow or later on this evening raising interest rates, and that will affect all emerging market currencies. And at least our politics are not being discussed when people are talking about selling emerging markets. They're highlighting Turkey. They're highlighting, again, as I said, Argentina. And there's another country just emerged on the radar. But South African politics are not being discussed. And we always go back to what could have happened. But if our politics was that bad, they would be highlighted there that, look, there's a Jacob Zuma and his ruling by proxy in the country and so on. So that is the one saving grace. Ramaphosa has given us some cushion. Although the Rand, being amongst the most liquid emerging market currencies, when people sell anything risky, the Rand is going to be hit hard. Let's just hope from this politics, I mean, from this Ramaphosa, there actually is some action. But in truth, maybe we've been too hard on him. There has been action, right? There has been lots of
Sikonathi, has there been enough action? Is this all about the world or is this about us?
It's definitely about the world. But here's one thing. Investors will always find the best in any situation. Now, our mining guys, are they crying because the rand is weakening? No, not at all. That gold price has suddenly become a whole lot better. The rand price of gold, the platinum price of gold. So there are many positives here. That's the one thing. But in terms of the state, has anything happened? It's the best 120 days of a president we've ever had. Cyril Ramaphosa came in, cleaned the rot out of Eskom, cleaned the rot out of Transnet. And what we do need, of course, to complete all of that is an arrest or two. Just one
good court case.
One arrest or make it three then. Good.
Take a few more, but yes, as you say, the first one will be
I'd actually prefer it if the first person to be arrested is Sean Abrams.
Seems very unlikely.
An optimist.
Well, yeah, that's very optimistic. Like, why? Like, what are we charging him?
For treason.
Dereliction.
For treason, for dereliction of duty. There's no way with this kind of evidence that we have had, not a single arrest, and the one that we have seen at Estina is really being cocked up deliberately.
Or
at the very top level.
So does that seem likely, given that we haven't even arrested Marcus Huster? That seems very unlikely.
I was going to say, there's such a choice of candidates we'd like to see let off to jail. It's kind of quite awesome.
Yes. But it's the best 120 days. The rand weakening now is really not such a big deal. And there are, as I have said, many benefits to it. Yes, of course, we cannot deny the fact that there are negatives, including the fuel price and all of that. But
looking on the upside,
yes, there's always an opportunity, and I am a trader by training, so there's always an opportunity to harvest here.
Speaking of Eskom, though, we've got Eskom offering its workers a 0% increase, and they are threatening to go out on strike. We've got South African Airways shedding people. Are we finally seeing the tough decisions being made at the ailing state-owned entities that we were hoping would turn them around? Rob?
I think so. I mean, this is very vital for Eskom to have said to them 0%. The unions don't like it. I think they've suggested a range of 9 to 12% as their negotiating position. But fundamentally, Eskom has been overstaffed for years. Sikonathi wrote a great column about it in this week's Financial Mail. They've been overstaffed for years, and the alternative really is cutting staff. I mean, do you, as a trade union, your motivation is to go there and lobby for higher wages. But if the alternative reality is you're losing a lot of jobs to sustain this, we can't have Eskom coming to the taxpayer every couple of minutes because they've wasted money. So that's the reality as well with SAA. So the public sector wage negotiation targets. That was 30 billion more than people expected. And I think Fitch raised that this week, or the IMF raised that this week. So there are issues around how we deal with our state-owned employees, and those decisions have to be made, and this is the start.
The workers are arguing, though, at Eskom, that why should they pay for the corruption and the mismanagement that has been happening at Eskom? Why should they pay for it by not getting salary increases?
I'm glad so you're calling it a 0% increase.
It's better than a decrease.
It's better than a 0% decrease.
Look, the reality of the matter is indeed the workers themselves cannot be blamed for Eskom massively inflating the job numbers, the staff, in order to create the jobs that the private sector failed to create, because we know why. They cannot be blamed for that. However, progressive trade unionists, and they really definitely need to be part of the solution rather than perpetuate the problem. That's where we are. So the NUMSA, of course, they get paid to extract money, subscription fees from the union members that they are going now to lose. That's just tough. That's what life is. Do you want to be part of the solution, or do you want to drag the whole nation down forever?
In the short term, though, Rondobi, are the lights going to stay on?
They will. I think they're doing the differentiation between the employees there that are, what's that,
community employees.
Yes, and those that have to stay on duty. So I don't think that the lights would go off. But I mean, the fact is, Eskom just does not have any money to bargain with. Yeah. And NUMSA has to come to the table and find some arrangement of how going forward they deal with this issue around on funding, around the organization's sustainability. I mean, for so long we've called on the main shareholder government to bail this thing out, but now stakeholders within Eskom need to sit down and say, okay, how do we keep this thing running as a going concern? And I think this is the moment. I think the board must be strong about it. I mean, the idea that Robert's talking about 9 to 12% and they're sitting at 0%. I mean, they're talking now bringing down to like 4% increase. At least I know there's some level of conversation,
I have a suspicion, actually, that markets are watching the outcome of this battle as a signal of whether the state in general and Eskom in particular are willing to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
Do you think this issue, if you like, has an importance beyond the kind of immediate issue of Eskom's own wage increases?
I think that it definitely is a precursor and a harbinger, I suppose, of what will decrease, increase. I think it's a harbinger of how they're going to be dealing with state-owned companies in future. They're going to say we're going to need to restructure these entities, specifically SAA, and we're going to have to take hard decisions, and we are overcapacitated. We have too many staff. You know, the statistics you saw of, passengers per staff member, gigawatts per staff member compared to other utilities across the world. It's a precursor to restructuring at our state-owned companies, which is necessary if we want to keep our government guarantees, our debt at state-owned companies within acceptable levels to get the economy back on track in a way that'll increase our rating back to investment grade.
But also like a lesson that bondholders control countries. Like, this is why I'm sure the people who give Eskom funding are the ones calling the shots now. Like, literally saying that, hey, this is... If you buckle on this, we're not giving you further funding. All the funding is going to salaries in any case. So they're like, we're not giving you more money to pay towards salaries.
And absolutely, that's the beauty about the market is that the bondholders call the shots.
Yeah, and now
Was it Bill Clinton's advisor who said the most powerful man in the world is the bond markets?
Yeah.
But now we don't want to say this out very loud. We don't want the trade unions to hear this. But Eskom is really at a disadvantage at this very point, in terms of if the trade unions, the non-core staff, do indeed carry out their threat and say we'll shut it down. It's in a precarious position in the sense that it does not have enough coal. It cannot exactly sustain a confrontation with the workers, and it's. It's coming at a rather awkward time. Had I been a manager at Eskom, I would definitely stock up first, make sure I've got all the coal I need, and take them on and win this fight. But this is not
what
even the biggest.
What are their stockpiles at now? Aren't there 20 days?
They are struggling. There are 7 power stations that don't have enough coal, and you don't want to go into a confrontation.
Don't have enough stockpiles.
Yes.
You don't want to go into a situation, a confrontation with your employees, when we are short, already short of coal stocks going into this. So they'll be fighting from the back foot. But
so will the union, because I mean, my experience of Eskom was that the workers routinely did threaten to strike, knowing full well that a strike that by Eskom workers is absolutely illegal and that they stand to lose their jobs. Eskom often caved in the past, but I don't think there's been an Eskom strike in my memory. There's a lot of placard waving, but not necessarily
there, there definitely has been a few people throwing rocks and dumping coal in front of the head office, and then they go back to work 3 hours later. That's going to be the case now.
If you're quite well paid, why would you want to lose your job?
But has Eskom management given the workers like a 5-year outlay? Okay, this year is 0%, maybe. Have they given them a...
The trade unions demanded a 1-year wage agreement. And Eskom responded to the 1-year wage agreement with a 0% increase.
It's a good point, though, Ron. Yeah. If one wanted to have the kinds of negotiations with workers that Sicko is talking about, where you have progressive unions who take on the issues of the sector, not just their own very short-term issues, you would want to be talking, in fact, long-term negotiations.
But you also want
to have long-term settlements, which would be about perhaps more than just wages, which would be about productivity.
Well, even that retrenchment applies. It's clear. We're finished building the group. We're finishing Zikusile. So there is retrenchment that will come with that,
and
paint it forward to them.
Look, those people that are building the two power stations are not the 47,000 people that work at Eskom. Those are additional people employed by
contractors.
But there's one thing we can't finish this discussion before actually a sustainable solution, not only for Eskom, but for this country in general. Workers deserve, their representative deserve at least a third of the seats on the board. Because if that were the case, everybody receiving the same information at the same time and no one thinking we are being, don't know if I can use this word on air, we are being screwed. But if you had at least a third of the board members representing workers, we would not have these many problems. Not only in the state, definitely in the private sector. And it has been done before in many countries, and they are still doing it now. Why can't South Africa do that?
Because what's the answer, Rob?
Ron's got the answer. I think it is feasible. I think you could do it. It has been tried overseas. I mean, the problem is to get the unions thinking beyond just a narrow factionalism to look at the sustainability of the enterprise in the longer term. So, I mean, a third of the board seats, I think you have to get workers on board to a greater sense.
They're the greatest stakeholder.
But I'm going to give Ron the last word.
I agree, German model works, but in South Africa, where there's this huge distrust between management and workers, where it's like literally wiped, like, even if you take a few union members onto the board, pretty much like the mining industry before Marikana, NUM was basically part of the board. Include NUM became part of management.
And we're going to come back to this. We're going to come back to this after the break. Welcome back. In the UK, new rules on executive pay have forced companies to disclose the gap between what executives get paid and what the average worker gets paid. And speaking of pay in our context with 0% increases, Rob Rose, would that be an appropriate rule to introduce in a South African context? And would it help with these kind of conflicts over wages?
I think that those are two different issues. I mean, is it an appropriate rule? Certainly the US is doing it now and the UK is doing it now. They thought that what it would do is help curb the most excessive increases for executives. It's in the Australian context, their rule, where if shareholders reject your pay by more than 25% for 2 years running, then all shareholders get to vote on an entirely new board. That has proven effective. The academic research says that it's led to some companies just not pushing through massive salary increases. I do think that the shaming mechanism of executive pay does work to some extent by saying the CEO is earning 4,000 times what his employee makes. But ultimately, I just don't know if that's a useful metric in terms of understanding how things operate. There are all kinds of dynamics that go into why people get paid what they're paid. And it's a very blunt instrument. But I suppose the perception that we have consultants who go there and sell massive increases to CEOs that are completely unjustified. One of the figures I found fascinating was this graph that showed companies where the CEOs get paid below the median versus those who get paid above the median, and the ones who get paid below the median were doing much better in terms of company performance. The company share prices are going far higher. So it's not as if, you know, when you pay your CEO ludicrous amounts of money that the CEO performs better. That certainly has broken that link, I think.
Would it address inequality in South Africa?
I don't think it would address inequality at all. I mean, that's a tiny part. Somebody made this point yesterday, and it was a very valid point, is that the real problem with inequality in this country is not so much the gap between somebody earning 10,000 rand a month and somebody earning 1 million rand a month. It's more the people earning 10,000 rand a month and people earning zero. Unemployment at 27%, that's the problem in the society. That's where inequality comes from. People don't have jobs, they have nothing. So that's the real thing we need to address. On the fringes, certainly curbing executive pay might help in inequality, but the real big issue in our society is joblessness.
So if one forced people to show the gap between executive pay and average worker pay, it would reflect inequality, Ron, among those who are employed, but it wouldn't really do terribly much to tackle unemployment.
No, it won't. It'll be us, those that are employed, and within the 60-odd percent of us who aren't really like the problem, but wouldn't deal with an underlying unemployment issue. So, but it would be a nice highlight just to see how the difference between high pay in South Africa amongst us as well. So it would be a nice highlight. Yes. And it would serve to embarrass, I guess,
those that are a bit Terence Goodlace, the CEO at Implats, the former CEO, he published the ratio between his staff members and his own pay, and he took a far lower salary as a result, but he was the only executive who did it. And he did take a lower salary.
And he rejected all bonuses.
And I'm not sure, did he reject all bonuses?
Yeah,
and the point is that he said, I'm thinking about these issues.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about what this means, what my staff members earn. So as a signal to your staff that you do think about these issues, and some degree of equity is necessary in a business, it's an important signal to your staff, I think.
Sekonati, does this in a sense link to that very same kind of thinking of possibly putting worker representatives on the board?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. Executive pay gets decided by the board. And when Ron talks about distrust, it's exactly because the workers are not there. Decisions are being made on their behalf by boards in which they are not represented. That's the whole thing. That's what causes the distrust. You need to put them in there. They're the biggest stakeholder in the business, after all, employees. Mm. So you need to put them on there and let them decide what their bosses will get paid. That's where exactly
what they will get paid.
Yes, and then the workers themselves, what they will
that
get paid.
That is the fundamental problem when it came to mining in this country. Pre-Marikana, I don't know, probably still the same thing right now, right? Where you get your union members basically becoming part of the board. Not officially,
the company paid for them.
That they lose touch with their members. That is the danger.
They played along with what management was saying. Whatever they're there for the workers, supposed to be there for the workers, they didn't deliver their core function. Mm. And anyway, in this country where there's a clear divide between workers and management, where management just is what the term umlungula, and the rest of us, until there's some level of one vision amongst all of us, it's not going to work. Germany works perfectly, but Germany is different. Germany has that, they had 1945, whatever case may be, after World War II.
So
they
have
everyone together, the same label. Correct. Here, hasn't happened. So how do you, that distrust, you can put all your unionists
in a board. Then let's do nothing about it and just kill
them. No, I'm not saying do nothing. Before we even do that, there's a bigger fundamental of getting us all to sing on one hymn sheet. Germany, clear. It's easy for Germany to do it. Japan, I'm sure it happened, right? But in this country, we almost need to first sing off one hymn sheet, and then you can trust. Then I would trust as a worker that my union representative on that board isn't selling me out.
Yeah? One last word on the subject.
Guess why we are not singing from the same hymn sheet? Because the others are shouting from outside, inside at management. They can only wave their placards from outside. When you bring them inside into the board with their members, there will exactly be no need for the others to be outside and shout in. They will all be here and be bound by the same decisions, the best interests of the company, and those are the best interests of the employees.
We're going to agree to disagree on this one. But Sig, I'm going to take you onto something which is related, which is that in this country we've gone a different route, which is we've gone the black economic empowerment route. We've brought black share. We have not brought workers into the board, and only to a limited extent to shareholdings in companies, but we have brought black people in broad-based or narrow-based forms into the boards and the shareholdings. Vodacom has just done a new BEE deal, which looks a little bit more innovative than most. Is this a deal which is addressing some of the flaws that these deals have had in the past?
It absolutely is a brilliant deal, but it's replacing an even better deal. In 2008, Vodacom did the Yebo Yetu transaction. Now, people that invested there, 60% of the 102,000 people, 531 that invested in that deal, 60% of them could only afford the minimum 2,500 rands. Now, that's 100 Yebo Yetu shares each. Those shares that they bought for 2,500 are today worth 12,500 rands, and they will remain invested and receive in October a special dividend of 68 rand. Now, show me anything that has delivered value to the ordinary person on the street, not the well-connected usual suspects and everything. 102,000 South Africans, black South Africans, participated, and this is the best foundation to build on which to build wealth. Vodacom is extending the deal at group level, and it's aiming at a 20% black shareholding from the current 17. And the best part about that deal was it was not exposed to the share price of Vodacom. It was exposed to the cash flows at group level. Sorry, at the local South African operation. That was the best thing. Unlike, unfortunately, the Sasol one, which was heavily reliant on the oil price and the share price, that delivered absolutely no value. Sasol, good for them, they have again refinanced that deal on terms better than the previously, and they are doing it exactly now into the operations of the company, into Sasol Mining, into the local operations like Vodacom did. And there is hope. You will have another 200,000 people in the case of Sasol that participated for the 10 years, got nothing, but they've got a new shot in the arm.
Are we doing these BEE deals better, Rob Rose? Because we can list how many of them have gone horrendously wrong in the past.
Yeah, I mean, initially black empowerment deals and companies failed badly. I mean, Nail is the primary example of a company that folded. But this particular deal, like Sekanati says, I think basing on cash flows of the South African entity, the underlying operating cash flows, is a much better way of doing it than share price, because share prices move up and down and do crazy things. And Sasol's operating cash flow wasn't as variable as its share price. That would have been a much better way to do it. I think people are thinking more about it to a greater extent.
Pinning it, in a sense, closer to the operations themselves rather than to markets. So, of course, the push initially for BE was at a market kind of level. People wanted equity, and they wanted equity market returns. And I suppose is there enough of a rethink going on about what BEE should look like?
Yeah, I don't think it's enough of a rethink. I think a lot of companies just are sitting back and thinking, once empowered, always empowered. We've done our deals. We're not going to do any more. And I think maybe there's room for them to certainly do more. But I think there is some innovation within the actual deals. This deal, Vodacom, and I think, for example, Standard Bank's deal, dealing with the SMEs, you know, doing deals with its SME providers, was a smart one. It's thinking, rather than just conventionally just take money in and, hey, we've got like black empowerment shielding of 20%, we can claim these points. It's about actually empowering your communities, the people who supply to you, in Standard Bank's case.
And SAB Miller did the same thing.
They've empowered a lot of people with the beer.
Actually, rather than the sort of rather formulaic approach, Ron, to via codes and so on, a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity has gone into some of the better deals. I mean, is there a way of distilling all the good stuff to create new deals?
I think we're still learning, but the telecom chairman had this example for us where how BE is so complex in this country still, where they have they want to buy fiber for this outlay of what, copper fiber, for this outlay,
fiber networks
and so on. One of the suppliers is a white company but employs 600 odd, and the majority of black employees. The other is one woman who just imports the copper from China and sells it on. But if they give a deal to her,
They get all the points.
And instead of giving it to this guy, although it has a bigger impact giving it to him, right? So, but I think we are sitting there, and there's the better companies, Sasols and so on, are looking for better ways of finding some sustainable solution towards these BEE deals. By the same token, not purchasing, as a black investor, when I get into a BEE deal, I want to be able to sell and make my profit and leave when I want to leave. I don't want to be locked in for 10 years. And that, I guess, is the big thing. So how do I, as a black investor, get a share in a company and leave when I want to and make my capital gains whenever I want? At the same, not hurting the company. I think that is fundamentally what we have to find an answer for. How does a black person get in and go out as he pleases? So I think that no one has quite got a hold on a solution.
Okay. I hope not anymore. Those are, but didn't we start by talking about
which
people we wanted to see in jail first? Yes. But I can't let this opportunity go. We have the World Cup, the Football World Cup opening this week in Russia. Of all places. So it seems to go from one corrupt regime to the next, Russia followed by Qatar. Who are you supporting, Sikonati?
World Cup, what's
World
that?
Cup football? Okay. Oh, he's a lost
That's
cause.
That's Liverpool.
Ron Darby. Supporting Liverpool. Ron Darby, who are you
Senegal.
supporting?
Senegal. I'm going with the... with Egypt, although I shouldn't go for North African countries, I have an issue with Morocco, but I'll go with Egypt and I'll go with again, Germany. I don't know.
Come on, there's Nigeria.
Yeah, no, Nigeria.
Senegal,
yeah, no.
And Nigeria's like, Senegal. You like can't support pirates. Liverpool there, chips unfortunately.
Yeah, it has to be Senegal. It can't be Nigeria. And yeah. Like Ron said, you know, the North African countries are the ones that voted against us, South Africa to host it. And, so and they, you know, there's a lot of ugliness. And so,
well, if you look at the performance of Bafana Bafana, you possibly can't blame them, you know.
Yeah, we've only played in two World Cups.
It's quite a lot, given
quite a lot.
Qualified
for two. 1998 and 2002 qualified, and then we bought the 2010. We were there. So three World Cups.
Cost us $33 billion to buy the rights.
Yeah, we bought. Okay, we bought the last one.
I still think we should have actually done a lot more with this 2010 World Cup. I mean, the infrastructure catalyst that it provided got us some roads, got us the train.
We'll get better.
Got
we'll
us some back. Buses. I think we should have actually spent more than.
I'm still a Bafana supporter. I haven't given up. One day.
It got Sepp Blatter a whole lot more though. So.
We get Sika's prediction.
No, I have no prediction to make, absolutely. Oh, well, I do. Bafana Bafana will not score a goal in the World Cup.
That's all we have time for. Happy football watching if you're a fan, and we will see you again next week.